Hello and welcome to the Atlanta Opera Podcast, The Business of Opera. The series is inspired by the programming of the piece, The Revolution of Steve Jobs at the Atlanta Opera in the spring of 2022. In preparation for the premiere of the show in Austin, Kansas City, and in Atlanta, we will have a series of interviews with business leaders, opera impresarios, artists, and strategic thinkers, as well as creative minds who will focus on two themes. Number one, the business of opera and the role of leadership in this business. And number two, the very controversial and mysterious character of Steve Jobs and the opera written about him. So I'm here with the board chair of the Atlanta Opera, my friend Reese Wilson, who is also a very successful attorney in Atlanta. And first of all, Reese, how are you doing and how you've been in this past crazy couple of years?
Doing great. The M&A world is very active right now, partly because of all the talk of tax changes in Washington. So there's a lot of activity right now. It is very, very, very busy, so, which is good.
Excellent. So you mentioned a mergers and acquisition. This is your day job as an M&A lawyer. Tell us a little bit about this day job, about your career.
Yeah, basically what I do is I help entrepreneurs sell their businesses. And I just think it's a lot of fun. I love entrepreneurs. They're some of the most interesting, creative, outside-the-box thinkers you could want to meet. And most of them have been working their tails off for about at least 20 years when they come to me and they're ready to sell their business. And so what I do is help them through the process, help them find the right people to take them through the process. I've also got a master's in tax, so I help them structure deals in the most tax efficient way. And then help them get to the closing, which for a lot of them, the emotional part is almost as big as the legal part, just because this is their baby. In many cases, they hired everybody in that company and they came up with a concept. They brought it all the way to fruition. And so while it's an exciting exit, it's also, again, as we say, it's the difference between being the head honcho and being the third guy in line in Starbucks. So it's a big change for some folks, but it's fun.
Excellent. So Reese, you're a man of many talents, and you also believe in giving back to the community. And you're focusing on the Atlanta Opera. You've given us more than a decade of board service in various roles. Why opera?
Well, it all started in my youth, Tomer. So I was very active as a musician in junior high school, and college. And in high school, for example, I played in the pit orchestra at our local little theater. We did two productions. One was South Pacific and the other was Damn Yankees. Really kind of fell in love with musical theater there. And then my freshman year at Duke, the director of the concert band took the whole group over to Vienna, Austria for a semester. And we were over there, and one of our courses that we were taking was music appreciation. And our homework assignment was to see 40 performances of something in Vienna, Austria, which in Vienna is actually very easy. The only problem is cost. So one of my friends told me that the Staatsoper, the state opera house, had these standing room tickets you could get for 50 pfennigs, which, you know, it was about the right price for a student. So I stumbled in there. The first opera I saw was The Magic Flute. And of course, I was instantly hooked, particularly when the three kids from the Vienna Boys Choir came roaring in as the sprites. They were wonderful. In any event, saw The Magic Flute four times, saw the full Wagner Ring Cycle, saw lots of other operas, and again, just really fell in love with it there. Kind of got away from it after I went back to Durham, back to college, in law school, came to Atlanta, married an amazing woman who loved Gilbert and Sullivan. And so we started going to the Savoyards here in town, which was a Gilbert and Sullivan troupe. And then I heard about this Atlanta opera that was getting started and how they were doing. And one of the board members, Tim Sheehan, told me, hey, I should come and check it out. Around that same time, my daughter was taking an enrichment course here in town, and a third grader. and the teacher was hooked on opera. And so she got them tickets to the dress rehearsal. And so that was my first performance with the Atlanta Opera. And we got hooked from there, became subscribers, and again, soon became a member of the board. And so I've been with it ever since.
That's a great story. And I love that your first opera in Vienna was Magic Flute. That was my first opera as a 13-year-old kid watching Bergman's Magic Flute and going, oh my God, I didn't know that this could happen.
Yeah, so that is an amazing, amazing movie. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you've been in the leadership position, which is no picnic, with the opera for a decade. So first you were a treasurer, then a vice chair. Now you've been a chair during the crazy days of the pandemic. There's a lot of drama in opera, especially in the leadership position. Can you tell us a little bit about your history with the Atlanta Opera and this past decade of leadership?
Yeah, so the first 5 years, it was actually 15 years, but who's counting, were just as a board member. And as a board member, everything seemed to be going really well. And, then I became treasurer. And I thought this was going to be the easiest job ever. We just received a $9 million bequest from Barbara Stewart. We looked at this. We took $3 million. We paid off all of the opera's debts. We took $3 million. We kind of jump-started our endowment. And then we had a $3 million cash reserve. We talked to management. They said, and this was before your time, they said, oh, we're going to have a balanced budget this year. No problem. So we had a $3 million cash reserve. We thought, this is going to cover us forever. We're set. Put it on autopilot. Well, unfortunately, we had an autopilot accident, and that is that the company lost $1.8 million that year, and that was cash lost. So our perpetual cash reserve went from $3 million down to $1.2 million. And at that point, the chair and I said, we've got to do something. We can't continue like this. And we went in, investigated, found out that there were some serious dysfunctions in the company. The financial reporting was a complete mess. Budgeting was a joke. And so the board chair wanted to fire the COO, I wanted to fire the CEO. We compromised. We fired them both, which was really stupid, but we did it. And got them out of there. And then I basically became the COO and CFO, and the board chair, Bill Tucker, became the CEO. And we ran the company for a year while we were looking for a new general director. So.
And this was what year?
2011, 2012. So 2012 was when, with the board, we made the decision to change management. And the 2012, 2013 season was with Bill and I kind of semi-running things. And then, we reached a decision on a new general director, Tomer Zvulun, in 2013, and then made that transition. And I've never been more relieved in my life than to have you come in and take over as general and artistic director.
That leads me into another question that I'm curious about. You know, one of the greatest challenges of a board of directors is a change of management, finding new leadership, supporting new administration. And when I look around at opera companies all over the map in the United States, I recognize that 50% at least of general directors are new in the past 3 years. Yeah. And there's a lot of turnover at the top. And my question to you is, how do you go about finding the right person? What is your advice to board of directors, to companies that are looking for a new CEO?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that this is a very difficult job to fill, because you're looking for someone who has a bundle of abilities that you usually don't find in one person. So you got to have somebody who has an artistic vision. Whether they're going to be an artistic director or not, they have to have the artistic vision to be able to make sure that everything happens. They have to have the ability to raise money and to do development work and to get donors excited about what they're doing. They also have to have at least some knowledge of financial statements, financial operations, how to manage that, and also have the ability to build a team around them. So often those sets of skills, you may get two or three of them in one person, but rarely do you find four. And so it's a very tough search. And what I would tell them, and and I was the hiring partner for a law firm for a number of years, and I ran a staffing company for a couple of years in my wasted youth. And so the thing that I tell people when it comes to recruiting is you need to give yourself time. And the biggest mistake people make in hiring is they hire too fast. You need to take your time. In our case, we took almost a year, which was very painful, but we did it right. We did a very comprehensive, very intensive process, and I think we ended up with a great outcome. We did end up with a great outcome. But that would be the advice to them is number one is you need to be patient. You need to talk to a lot of people. I would encourage you to get a recruiting firm involved to help you find the best candidates, and then just take your time and be patient. And you may decide you can only find two or three of those things in one person, and then you need to figure out how you're going to compensate for what's left. Is it more training? Is it a really strong CFO? How do you do that? But that's why I think you see the turnover is that people think this person could do all those things, and they really can't, and they end up failing. And you know, the other thing you've got is that it's also very challenging because if your board is not united in their vision for the company, the director's in a terrible position. They're getting pulled in various directions by different factions. It makes it almost impossible to do the job. So it's a very tough job.
Well, and I thank you for your leadership of the board these past years. The subject of this conversation, this podcast, is called The Business of Opera. Opera and business. Is that an oxymoron? Is it possible to have a strong business when you have an opera company involved?
It is, but it's not easy. The one thing I have learned is that if your business model is to do the top 20 grand operas on the main stage, and by the way, I love grand opera. I love a full stage with singers and chorus and a big pit full of musicians, the sound, big productions with sets and costumes, the whole thing. I love the pageantry. I love the whole thing. But if that's going to be your business model, you better get used to riding on the struggle bus, because it's not going to work. And the reason it's not going to work is that grand opera is hideously expensive. And if you're lucky, you may cover half the cost of your production with ticket sales. More likely less than that. You're usually going to lose somewhere between $500,000 to maybe $1 million on each production that you do if you're doing grand opera. So so where does the rest of the money come from? By the way, you also have to add in there the staff costs, overhead costs, all that. So if you're lucky, your ticket sales are going to cover about 30% of all your costs. So where does the rest of that money come from? It comes from development. It comes from donors. You're always going to have hardcore donors like me who love grand opera. I'll give money to that. But what you're going to find is when you go to foundations and talk to them about it, if you're doing the same old, they generally not interested in investing in you. They want to invest in something that's making a positive change in the community and in moving things forward. And you're also going to have a hard time attracting other donors because it's basically just going to be your hardcore group. So you better do a really good job of raising money out of that group. And even if you do, you're always going to be on the edge of failure. So that doesn't work. So what does work? What does seem to work is a lot of what you're doing, Tomer, and that is your mantra of increasing artistic risk while reducing financial risk is exactly the way to go. And, I think when I first heard that and first started seeing it go into place, the thing that was appealing was that you're bringing cost down per production, and that way you don't have to have so much at risk with each production. What I didn't really catch on to until later was that's how you attract new donors. That's how you attract foundation support. That's how you attract the community support, by doing more interesting, innovative works in addition to doing the grand opera works. And as you do that, you're able to grow your donor base. And if you grow your donor base sufficiently and you get support from lots and lots of people and lots of foundations, then suddenly you have something that makes sense from a financial standpoint. And it just gives you so much more flexibility to do things you really want to do from an artistic standpoint. So it's a little bit counterintuitive in a way. I mean, you would think, oh, gee, do the safe thing. You're going to sell a lot of tickets. You know, just do, the top 20. But if you do that, you're always going to struggle. So it's a little counterintuitive, but I think it can be done.
I have to say that this mantra of increasing the artistic risk and lowering the financial risk is something that I stole from our mutual friend, the vice chair, Charlie Yates, who always said that. And that's how the Discovery Series started, because right. ultimately you cannot take the risks on the main stage as easily as you can take them when you do smaller scale shows. And that's what we've been doing here. Right. But now, being a board member in a not-for-profit can be a very elusive and tricky task, because you have to walk this line between making decisions and stepping away and not crossing the line between governance and management. I feel like there's a lot of board members, not only just in opera companies, but also just in performing arts in general, that find it tricky to define what is it that they do and how they should go about that. And so, do you have any advice to anybody who's looking at joining a non-for-profit?
Well, I think the first thing, first piece of advice is only do it if you're passionate about what the not-for-profit is doing. Don't just do it to pad your resume or something like that, because you're really not doing them any great service. If you're passionate about it, the problem that you have if you have passionate board members is they're passionate about the art form and what you're doing, and they often have strong opinions. These people are often very successful in their own right. And so the challenge for them, and some of them may be CEOs of companies used to calling the shots, they may be high-powered lawyers who are used to people following their advice. And so they have to learn, and I think this part of this can be maybe an orientation, I'm not sure, is that your job is not to come in here and tell these folks what to do. Your job is to come in here and make sure that you've got a top-notch management team that knows what to do, because that management team is always going to know more about this art form or this program, this project, whatever it is that this not-for-profit is doing, than you will ever know as a board member. So the key is to hire the very best management and to, you know, apply some pressure to them when need be to make sure they're doing what they need to do. But at the same time, you have to let them do their job because they'll always do it better than you ever could. And so that's a tough lesson for people to learn, and it's tough to know the balance between trying to be helpful and being disruptive. And so the biggest thing is, please don't be disruptive. Don't go around the CEO or the executive director, you know, directly to their direct reports. Don't do anything to undermine them. Don't do anything to undermine the team. And always support the leader in what they're doing. And if you get to a point where you don't think the leader is the right leader anymore, fine, that's the board's job, is to make that change. But until that time, you need to get behind that leader, and you need to support them and make sure that everybody supports them.
So Reese, you spoke a little bit about some of your challenges. And as you think about them, and I cannot imagine identifying that there's a problem a decade ago, making the choice to address the problem, going through it, because it's not easy to take a drastic move like that, and then going through the process of finding somebody, the exhausting process of interviewing people, finding that person, helping them for the first few years because it's a mess and it takes time to turn the ship around. But as you think about those challenges and you think about your greatest triumph, the moment that you just was able to finally breathe and maybe turn to Caroline and say, all right, this is worth it. What is that moment of triumph that you remember that made it all worth for you?
Well, I think there are really two. One is in terms of the change in management. I think it came when I think, Tomer, when you got back from the Harvard program is when I said, okay, we're there now. The other thing that was there was when you discovered that you were a natural fundraiser and very good at development, because that was the biggest question mark we had in hiring you was, you know, could you raise money? And the second was, could you build a team underneath you? And so, you know, I think I'm not sure what the exact point was, but it was somewhere a couple of years in, that it was like, okay, you know, this guy's got it, and he's got all the tools, he can do everything here. So, you know, now we can step back, let Tomer run the ship along with his great team and just enjoy things. And then the second time was when COVID hit. And, you know, that was such a devastating time. I can only imagine for you and for the rest of the staff. I mean, we had an absolute blockbuster season lined up for 2021. I mean, just incredible. And I there's no telling how many hours you all spent lining up everybody, all the singers, the productions, but I mean, everything you had to do to get that season in place and, you know, the promotions, everything. And then this thing hits. The thing that I did is I read everything I could get my hands on about COVID. That's what I do. I'm a reader. And it became clear to me that we were not going to be able to perform in a theater in 2021. And so one of the times when I had to kind of step in and say, hey, guys, was to pull the emergency brake and say, we're not going to be able to do 2021. And I've never been prouder of a group of people than when I saw what you and your team came up with in response to that, with the big tent, with all the safety precautions that you were able to put together, the idea of having a, you know, basically a rep company group of singers that were going to be there to perform in all of your performances. I mean, it was just an absolutely brilliant pivot. And I was just so happy and so pleased about that. That was probably my greatest point of happiness as being involved with the Atlanta Opera, or really any organization. Just incredibly proud with how you guys responded to that. Because again, I know it had to be devastating to just take all that work you've done, just push it off the table and say, okay, we have a clean piece of paper. What are we going to do? So incredible work, really.
Well, and I gotta give you some credit here, because during those days, we were on the phone a lot, and you had some really important points that really helped moving forward in the direction that we moved. And it's funny that you talk about COVID, because that's my next focus. I feel like we live in a world that eventually is going to look back on this time and think about it as before COVID and after COVID, BC and AC. And when you think back to March 13, 2020, making those hard decisions of, we are canceling Porgy and Bess, a sold out production. We are laying off 35% of the staff because we have to cut down on costs. We are purchasing a circus tent because we think that maybe we can do a show in a tent outside. When you think about all those crazy decisions, and you kind of try to crystallize leadership heuristics, leadership advice to people in the future of things to do and things not to do, what comes to your mind?
Well, the first thing is that you have to accept reality, no matter how much you may not like it. You have to accept reality. You have to start where you stand and deal with things as they are. And the mistake that so many people made and make in any kind of crisis is that they just are in denial for the longest time. And you got to get past that, and you got to accept what's happening, and then you can make your pivot and move. The second thing is you have to move quickly. And that was the other thing that we talked about, is you have to move quickly and decisively. You can't hold back. You can't wait for further developments. You can't wait for more information. You've got to move. You've got to act. So I think that's the case in any situation, in any business or a nonprofit, is you have to deal with what's in front of you, and you have to adapt to it as quickly as you can. And if you do that, as we talked about, you can actually turn that crisis into an opportunity where you can get ahead of the crowd and be the winner, which is what the Atlanta Opera did. So that's, to me, that's a lot of what that's about in terms of decision-making and leadership, is to lead.
And, you know, this podcast is inspired by our programming, and our programming has bookending shows. Opening of the season is Julius Caesar. Closing of the season is Steve Jobs, two major leaders that changed the world 2,000 years apart. Both died when they were 56, both extremely controversial, extremely admired, and extremely vilified on the other hand. And when you think about leaders, leadership, your leadership, what is the role of leadership in setting a tone? What are your own strategies?
The thing that you want to try to do, which I think old Julie kind of lost sight of at least, was that you want to have consensus and you want to build a team and work with a team as much as possible. Because no matter how brilliant you may be, if your team is not with you, you'll fail. And of course, Julius Caesar failed in the most dramatic fashion, being murdered. Hopefully I won't have to face that. But the point is that you got to make sure that you're doing this as a team process. Leadership is a team sport. You can take the Steve Jobs approach if you're a brilliant genius. Okay, great. You can go that route. But the reason that Apple is successful is not just because of his genius, but it was because he had a team underneath him that could take that genius and turn it into reality. So again, you really got to focus on the team, make sure you've got a strong team underneath you, and get the best people you possibly can to be on that team. And if you do that, you'll have the greatest chance of success.
And I would argue that Steve Jobs had two lives, really, and he was murdered too when he did not have a team around him that supported him. He was fired from Apple, and then he came back. And I think he was wiser when he came back because he realized what you just said, that, you know, you can be as brilliant as you want until tomorrow, but if you are not self-aware, you will be stabbed. Yeah. Now, talk about leadership, and I love it that you think so much about it. For many years, you've been involved with Vistage, which is a group that brings together leaders and CEOs from different companies. It's a group that realizes two things that every leader, I think, should realize. Number one is that growth and learning never end. Doesn't matter how many business school you attended. And that it's also lonely at the top. And finding people that you can share your experiences with, colleagues that you can talk to, is not only essential to your network and to continuing to develop your skill, but also to your mental health. And Reese, you've been with Vistage for quite a few years. You also received the Lifetime Achievement Award with them. First of all, congratulations. Can you tell us a little bit about this program and why do you find it so important?
Well, what Vistage does is it brings together CEOs, and I think there are like 4,000 members of Vistage worldwide, but it's broken down by groups, and within each group, there's usually somewhere between a dozen and 18 members in each group. And in my group, there's me, there's an accountant, and then there are 16 CEOs of private companies. And so, you know, again, it's the function it performs is we get together once a month. And sometimes we have an outside speaker, but to me, the most valuable sessions are when we just simply what we call process issues. And so it gives an opportunity for these CEOs to come in and talk about the challenges that they have. And 90% of the time, it's people. And the thing that's reassuring to them often is that there's somebody else in the room that has dealt with exactly the same kind of situation. I can tell you this is how, you know, he handled it or she handled it. This is how they would advise you to do it. And so it's very comforting to those CEOs to have that ability, because within their company, anybody they talk to in the company is somewhat beholden to them and in many cases are trying to figure out, well, what does he or she want me to say, and trying to give you the answer that they think you want, as opposed to giving you just a straight scoop. And then even if you're the other way that CEOs know folks, other CEOs are usually in their industry. Well, you don't want to go to somebody else in your industry and tell them about the problems you're having with your head salesperson. So again, Vistage gives that safe environment. It's all confidential. It all stays in the room. And again, just gives them that outlet to be able to just do that. Plus it gives them a chance to make some friends who, really, again, are not beholden to them, don't have any vested interest in making them happy, but are just really smart, talented, capable people. So it's been a lot of fun. And, you know, I think 25, 26 years been doing that. So a lot of sessions with a lot of leaders, which the other value to me has been to just be able to see that there isn't one right way to do anything. There are lots of different ways to do anything. And there are lots of different kinds of people who can be successful leaders. And so it's seeing each of their styles, seeing which styles work in what environments, what situations. It's been very helpful to me.
That's amazing. And it also reminds me so much of the executive program that I've been to in Harvard, because it's very similar in that you are connecting with a lot of people that have nothing to do with your field, which is challenging at first. But then I think that's the way to go, because you want to have many perspectives. We talked a lot about the past 10 years, the 2011-12 season, and the need to make a change, and then the past 10 years and the trials and tribulations that you've been through. When you think about the next 10 years, what is your hope?
Well, two things come to mind. One is that we succeed in our mission of becoming the major international opera company that Atlanta deserves. And I think we're on track for that. If anything, COVID accelerated that track. And I'd like to see us kind of get back towards what we were doing. I think we're making a good start with this season, and hopefully we'll get there. The other thing that comes to mind is that I want us to see us make real meaningful strides in equity, diversity, and inclusion. To me, to be the Atlanta Opera means we need to be the opera company for all of Atlanta. And so I want to see that those initiatives work, starting at the board, to volunteers, to performers, to patrons, everyone involved with Atlanta Opera. We want them to look like the city of Atlanta.
Well, this sounds like we're going to have a good decade ahead of us. And I want to thank you for everything you've done for Atlanta Opera and continue to do. But I also want to thank you for being so open about how the sausage is made. I think it's important. I think it's not something that people hear often. And I hope that it's going to be able to help people as they either volunteer for the opera or try to pursue a leadership position. So thank you, Reese Wilson, for everything you do.
My pleasure. And don't let me scare you off. It's actually a lot of fun. Come on in.
I would say the same. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.